Hey, resilient recruiters, here's reason number two why you must attend the Recruitment Coach Live Summit in London this September. And that is the keynote presentations. You'll gain exclusive insights from other top billing recruiters and entrepreneurs who've either scaled their own desk or built multi-seven-figure businesses. I myself will, of course, be one of the speakers, but the presentations that I am the most excited about are not professional speakers and trainers, but other recruitment business owners like you who will be unpacking their most effective tactics and strategies. No theory, just practical insights from people who are in the trenches, ordinary people achieving extraordinary results. There's still time to take advantage of the early bird pricing. By the way, it's happening on September 17th and 18th. So don't miss out. Reserve your place now at recruitmentcoach.com/summit. Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. This is your host, Mark Whitby. I'm delighted to be joined today by Doug Baird. Doug is the CEO at New Street Consulting Group, a people advisory firm that helps their clients to find, assess, build, and accelerate teams and leaders who are good, as good in practice as they are on paper. Doug has over 25 years experience in recruitment and professional services. He's created managed companies within interim management, executive search, and leadership consulting. New Street Consulting has been ranked as one of the best small companies in the UK, and they've previously ranked in the Sunday Times Fast Track 100. And Doug himself has been a finalist in the Ernst & Young Entrepreneur Award. Doug, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Wow, that's quite an introduction. Thank you, Mark. Very much appreciated. I'm delighted to be with you here today.
Fantastic. So we know each other through Katie Howard, who recommended you to me. I understand Katie's now joined you at New Street Consulting Group.
She has, yes. Off to a flying start. Been with us a few months now. Delighted to have her on board.
She is definitely a superstar, so you are lucky to have her. She was one of my very first guests on this show way back, episode 15. I would encourage our listeners, if you haven't heard that episode, to check it out. It was called How Katie Howard Cross Empowers Women in Recruitment to Excel. And it was just such a fantastic interview. And what's special about Katie is that she is a really high achiever, but she's also very down to earth and very, you know, grounded and always looking to learn, to improve, and to also share and help others in our industry. So I'm really glad that she's connected us.
Well, I've got some big shoes to follow. If that's the right expression, but yeah, you're absolutely right. She's wonderful, really great in terms of some strong opinions on the D&I agenda.
Yes, absolutely. That's one of her superpowers for sure, is in that area.
It is indeed.
Okay, fantastic. So talk to me about New Street Consulting Group and how and why you started the firm, Doug.
Well, it wasn't always New Street Consulting Group. I actually started a company called Interim Partners in 2003.
Okay.
And back then, we our name kind of said it. We did interim management. We wanted to be what it said on the side of the tin, as it were. And we had a clear route to market. You know, I didn't want to be an executive search firm then because I thought that there was lots of competition. But I did want to deal with the C-suite, and I did want to operate with really big corporates, big companies, help them through change. So we were particularly focused on interim management, and we grew that business over a number of years. It was really successful. We did really well, and I loved it. But I think you reach a point in your career, indeed, in the maturity of a business, when you then sort of think to yourself, well, what's next? What are we going to do next? And as an entrepreneur, I've always been fascinated by the journey. So a good few years ago, we began to think, you know, what do we really want to do? And we'd started other businesses. And indeed, we bought a company called Wicklam Westcott. And that was really our opportunity to pivot towards being a consulting business.
Interesting. So let me just clarify. So Interim Partners, you launched in 2003, so quite a while ago. And then...
Yeah, I'm feeling old.
Likewise. So then is New Street a separate company from that, or did it develop into New Street, like rebrand or?
We rebranded. We had three or four companies. We had one called New Street, which was executive search. We had one called Interim Partners, which was our core offering, supplying interim managers. We had a little financial services recruitment business called Brightpool that was involved in remediation, but it began to supply, it sort of grew and it began to supply contractor teams and agile teams. So I guess we had the beginnings of a range of talent solutions, but back then we sort of called them all different things, and it was all confusing for us, a bit confusing for the market. So I think we went from an entrepreneurial strategy, how do we make money, how do we seize opportunities, to perhaps more of a traditional strategy, which is how do we make this cohesive, how do we put our businesses together to have a strong message to market. And I guess the thinking was, we had these small businesses, they were niche, and being niche has its benefits, but it was a little bit like three small businesses squeaking in the marketplace, and we wanted to bring them together to create an amplification, a bit of a roar in the market as opposed to a squeak. And that's what we were doing. And I think over that period of time, you know, it wasn't really a case of rebranding to becoming New Street Consulting Group. It was actually pivoting to consulting. It was thinking, what is it we actually want to do as a business? And so we went through all of that thinking about how do we engage with leaders to assess them, or, you know, how do we help our clients with development projects? These were sorts of things we did, and that really helped, and we bought Wicklund Westcott, who specialised in that. So it was putting those things together, putting that jigsaw together that has allowed us to pivot to being a consulting business. So where we are today is about half our staff are involved in recruitment. We call that talent acquisition, and the other half are involved in talent consulting, and that could be involved in, they could be psychologists, they could be doing assessment work, they could be doing development or cultural audits, or they could be providing insight. So we've sort of got a blend of those solutions that we wrap up together to call New Street Consulting Group.
Love it. It makes a lot of sense that you genuinely have a range of solutions to offer to help clients solve problems and to change and transform, rather than just having one thing that you have to push, you know, on clients, whether it's quite the right fit or not. So what's the sort of...
Mark, on that point, you know, I must admit, I loved having one thing. It was great. It's a singular message to market. But what we've discovered is clients don't really want one thing, in our opinion, anyhow. What they want is a solution. They want a range of ideas, and they want you to be creative, and they want you to think about what's best for them and how it's tailored to them. Mm-hmm. So having a single solution, unfortunately, is not the strategy that we wish to follow.
Well, I do want to dive into that, but first, could you just give me a picture of the size and shape of New Street Consulting Group now?
Well, I'm pleased to say that we're recovering. We're having a strong quarter, touch wood. So I think this year will probably be about 11 million net fee income.
Wow,
so that will be our best year. In context, we didn't do so well over the pandemic, I'm sorry to say. I know some businesses did do well. We didn't do as well as we'd hoped. But in 2019, pre-pandemic, we were just shy of 10 million net fee income. So with that sort of size, and we're in that sort of 60-odd staff, we hope to be at about 80 by the end of this year. So I think we're not quite an SME of two or three people. We're probably middle-sized. Would you describe us as middle-sized? But we're not too big either. We're sort of on that journey of growing.
Beautiful. And I think you have offices in London, Manchester, Leeds. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay,
yes.
Fantastic. So I want to talk about how you've successfully grown, and because I'm sure there's some really key insights you can provide there. But just while we're on the topic of solutions, what you've accomplished actually is, I would say, quite remarkable, because often, well, first of all, clients don't always know what they may think they know what they want, and like, we need to hire a, you know, a blank, whatever job title, or they think they know how to buy recruiting services, or they have a preconceived idea, or they've got an established process. And what you've got actually is much more than that. And I'm just wondering how you get, in order to be able to sell the range of solutions you've got, you have to interface with the company at quite a senior strategic level and get them to open up to you about what their vision is, what challenges they're experiencing, and not get sort of pushed, you know, shunted down to, like, let's say a head of talent or an HR director or even a line manager who's just thinking about their talent needs within their team, how do you create those meaningful strategic conversations at the right level so that that opens the door for everything that you have to offer?
That's a good question. I guess we're fortunate in terms of our heritage, which is we were placing interim managers at a senior level. We were placing CEOs with chairs or CFOs or group HRDs, those types of people into organizations. Of course, we're placing more junior interim managers as well, or less senior, I should say. But when you're having those senior engagements and you're talking about interim management, it's generally because they've got a real appetite to change or to bring in some skills that are different to their business. And so not all businesses are in that position. Some obviously have fantastic internal talent teams and their recruitment processes are running very smoothly. Others, they're going through transition, change. They may have bought a big company or merged or whatever is happening on their corporate agenda. And so they're wanting to buy in expertise. Well, when you're having a conversation about, you know, the broader changes in the business and less about the recruitment processes, you really get those sorts of insights, and it gives you the opportunity to broaden the conversation quite quickly and say, look, we could help you here, or we could help you over there. And if they perceive you to be a trusted partner that can provide a good service, then they're open-minded. And then it's up to you really to pitch something, you know, create a proposition that's tailored to them, that's really going to help them solve their problems. And of course, each client is different. But, you know, the trick is to listen, to engage, to understand, and then to craft something that's going to be really suitable for them. But, you know, we're fortunate. We're not in the staffing business. You know, we're not one of these great big RPOs that's trying to do everything to everybody. We of course, we'll deal with people right across the spectrum of business, but we really engage with the C-suite.
Now that you've explained it, it's so obvious, Doug, but I'm glad that you spelled that out for me so I can get my head around this. Of course, your original core business of placing interim managers has put you right there in the mix, in the conversation, because presumably when companies are hiring an interim manager, it's because they are looking to create some kind of change or transformation. They want an outside fresh perspective. They want someone who's going to, you know, drive change, make significant improvements, and you know capture some kind of value or increase in ROI. And so it's almost like the candidates you're placing can bring you into that organization in a sense.
Yeah, they're like the pioneers, you know, going forth. And of course, there may be consulting businesses involved with the organization already. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they may not want to, or may not have the opportunity to put in people in an executive capacity. Mm. So if you're wanting to introduce, a director of change and transformation, or even a CFO to help with a disposal project, you know, those sorts of people, they really need to be within the business and less so from a consulting environment. I seconded. So what it does is it gives us that insight into the organization. But, you know, it's not just that. I think we're also fortunate to buy Wicklam Westcott, which no longer called Wicklam Westcott. So you probably don't know the name, but it was a few years ago before it was New Street Consulting Group. And it was a fantastic business because they were involved in leadership assessment and development. And so, again, they're talking to the C-suite and they're talking to them about how do they assess the leaders, what's really good, what are the skills required in their organization. So I think we've come from it, a little bit of a pincer movement from a few different directions. I think it's fortuitous, but that happened, a little bit of luck as well. But we do have these two communities of people that we're dealing with that really lead us to the same place, which is, you know, how do we provide those solutions to our clients?
And what's brilliant about the way you've structured this is that there's a great opportunity for cross-selling. Once you're embedded in an organization, you have relationships, then you can then introduce other other services. I could be wrong, but I've not come across this very often, where a smaller business of your sort of size is growing through acquisition. Can you talk to me about why and how you accomplished that?
Well, we wanted to pivot to being something different, and this would have been probably 2017-18 when we were going through these exercises internally as a management team. And I must admit, if I'm really honest with you, I didn't think we were going to be acquiring a company. I thought we were just going to, you know, hire a few people and go on the journey that way. But we were fortunate. We were introduced to Wickham Westcott. We hit it off with their management team, and so we saw the opportunity to buy them. And with everything, there is always a little bit of luck and timing in these things. And one of the principals there, he wanted to retire. He'd been in the business 30, 40 years, done a fantastic job, and he wanted to move on. So that created an opportunity for us to talk to the existing management team, who are still with us, people like Colin Mercer, fantastic, experienced psychologist. It was a real opportunity to talk to people like that and say, look, would you like to work with us and join our business? Fortunately, they said yes.
Okay, interesting. So your original goal, which I think is the well-trodden path, if you're going to grow, it's you would then hire people with the market knowledge or the skills that you're looking to build into. How did that evolve into this different conversation where you're actually buying the business instead of just building a team?
Well, it evolved because they were looking for an exit. But I think it was a fantastic opportunity for us because at the moment we are growing our service lines through hiring some great people. Last week we just had somebody who's an ex-PwC partner within the talent space has agreed to join us. So we can we, you know, it's fantastic that we can acquire talent like that and introduce them into the business. And I'm sure that will have an impact in its own way. But if you really want to accelerate, and if you think about it, we were predominantly a recruitment business wanting to be something different. We had to be honest with ourselves. We didn't have the skills internally to be able to do what we wanted to do. So we had to go out and get that. We had to acquire it because I think it would have been a long road, persuading people one at a time to grow iteratively. We just needed to, we saw this opportunity and we saw, hang on a minute, we've got some people here with a completely different skill set. Wouldn't it be amazing if we could work with them? So that really allowed us to accelerate our thinking. But around that time we were still interim partners, New Street, Wickham, Westcott. That was really just one part of the jigsaw that allowed us to go on this journey of pivoting to being New Street Consulting Group.
Interesting. So then they, so this is going back, what you said, to 2017, so about 5 years ago.
Yeah,
And
it was 18, 19 when the acquisition was going
okay.
through. So they weren't long with us before the pandemic struck. And of course, I think it was probably in 2019 that, we thought to ourselves, well, we don't want to rebrand because rebrand seems a little bit superficial. So we wanted to get the building blocks right first. We wanted to actually have the stuff to be able to go to market to talk about. And we did that. And we planned to rebrand in 2020. Obviously, the pandemic sort of arrived and we just carried on our mission to rebrand. And we did that by the summer of 2020.
Got it. Okay. You might remember back in episode 43, I talked to Plamen Ivanov, the executive chairman of iIntro. If you missed it, it's well worth going back into the archives and having a listen. One of the things we talked about was a way for recruiters to shift the conversation with prospects away from fees and make it all about value. iIntro has created a tool called the Bad Hire Calculator that you can show to your prospects that proves to them that your recruitment service will save them potentially hundreds of thousands of dollars. When you can do that, the exact fees you charge almost become immaterial because you've proved that you will save the client the most money in the long run. If you'd like to add this tool to your arsenal, you'd be pleased to know that I've partnered with iIntro and they're offering a 25% discount to listeners of the Resilient Recruiter podcast. All you have to do to claim this discount is book a free consultation and mention my name or this podcast. Just go to recruitmentcoach.com/retained, follow the instructions, and iIntro will take care of the rest. That's recruitmentcoach.com/retained. So if we can shift gears and look at the process of growing a business, because you've built a really successful business, Doug. Now it's not happened overnight. I mean, you've been at this for over, well, I guess, what did we say, 20, 2003,
I don't want
so
to say, Mark.
almost 20
It's been that
years.
long.
What do you think have been the key factors, success factors in that journey, Doug, or the key pivot points that you, looking back, you can think, well, that was a key, driver of growth that we got that part right.
There's been a number of them. You know, I'm wondering if you're going to ask me all the stuff I've got wrong.
Yeah, of course, that's next. So,
you know, and I think when we talk about success points, I don't know. It's hard to look back and think what was a particular success. However, you can see moments that you pivoted or leapfrogged from one place to the next. I don't know about you, but I still kind of feel like I'm at the beginning of my journey. Apart from when I look in the mirror and I realise I'm a little bit older, but I still feel sometimes new at what I'm doing. I'm at the beginning of the journey. It's still fresh and exciting when you're doing something different. So I don't really feel like a success or even an overnight success. And if it's been a long overnight, if that's the case. But I think when we started out, we had a very different mission to the one that we have today. And, you know, that's part of how the business has evolved. In my first few years, it was about surviving. My mission then was, you know, how do I feed my family? How do I make a few extra pounds to go on a nice holiday? It was those types of things. Clearly, that as a mission doesn't inspire people to join you, I'm afraid to say. You know, so you can't ultimately have an entrepreneurial mission within your business. But back then, you know, we were a northern-based business that was punching above our weight, and we were on a train traveling a lot to London. So I guess one of the first things we decided to do was to plant a flag in the ground in London and try and make a success of having an office there. And that took a lot of effort because it took us away from our friends and families, and we were often away in the week a lot. So I think attempting to be London-centric, although very expensive, you know, began to give us a slightly different footprint and a different perception in the marketplace. I think beyond that, we were successful. We won a few awards. I was lucky enough to meet Richard Branson, all those sorts of things that you do when you're small. But of course, when you're tiny and you're doubling, it's quite easy to double when you're tiny. It becomes a bit harder when you're a lot bigger. So, you know, the fast track is really for very small companies that can get to, you know, sort of a medium size. And we were fortunate enough to be one of those. But I think if I was to look back, I think up until about 2013, 2014, over that 10-year period, we'd done pretty well from a financial point of view, and we'd attracted some really good people. Some good people had worked with us and moved on and became successful elsewhere. I think, though, almost the opposite to success happens, which is when you feel a slight sense of dissatisfaction. And that sometimes that sense of dissatisfaction is the thing that motivates you to try something different or to be something different. And, you know, I don't want to sound like it's sort of a negative motivating factor that you're a grumpy whatever and you're getting out of bed, you're not happy with your lot. But I think you begin to think about what is it you're really wanting to do with your life and your career. And interim management had been fantastic, but we saw other opportunities like remediation or financial services contracting. So we started a business called Brightpool. And of course, we wanted even then we knew that we wanted to be able to have more meaningful conversations with our clients. And so just offering interim management, whilst it was really amazing to be able to provide that service, lots of clients wanted an executive search, and we couldn't provide that. Certainly very difficult to pitch for one when you're called interim partners. So, you know, I think even then we were realising, hang on a minute, we probably need to offer more services. And there's some great businesses out there that are search and interim. But when we really looked at the marketplace and what we wanted to be, we decided that probably wasn't for us. We didn't want to be another search and interim business. We wanted to be a talent solutions business. So it's probably been, at least from 2015 onwards, we've been having this sort of itch that we've wanted to scratch. And I've got to be honest, it's been a really long journey. But certainly the success factors, or the pivot points, as you might describe them, they would be things such as buying another business, having the courage to rebrand and almost to walk away from what you're famous for. Famous, I say, in a famous with a small F. But, you know, what you're known for, what you're renowned for, you know, that was a bold move, I think. And, you know, we had to be brave about it. But along the way, some really good things are happening. You need to find the right talent. That's essential. And you need to create the right structures. You need to have the right governance, and you need to get the right tech. So all sorts of other things begin to emerge as you realize, hang on a minute, we want to pivot. But what are all those nasty scale challenges we need to go through? And I guess there's been a number of small successes in terms of getting through those scale challenges.
Fantastic. I mean, you've highlighted sort of four pillars there. One is talent, structure, governance, and technology. So we might explore those in more detail. But it's really interesting you talked about dissatisfaction. Tony Robbins says that, you know, being dissatisfied is one of the best ways to, you know, to achieve more or to, you know, be motivated. If you're satisfied with everything as it, you know, the status quo, then there's no impetus, right, to make things happen, to create new things. But what specifically was the source of dissatisfaction?
Well, I think there's lots of things, really, if I'm honest. I'm quite a curious person. So I think when I was... I can't remember exactly when it was, but we were making good profits. We were perceived to be good in the marketplace. And a few people said to me, oh, fantastic, Doug, why don't you sell the business and you could start another one? And I began to think about that as an idea. I thought, oh, this sounds quite good. Maybe I go and play golf, or I do what other sort of middle-aged people do when they've just sold their business. And I had a long, hard think about that as an idea. And I guess a couple of things happened. One, I was terrified of not being able to work. I wondered what I would do with my time. Trust me, I do have interests outside of work, but you know, this notion of sitting on a beach, seeing it sounded great for a few weeks, but not for the rest of my life.
That would be terrible, but, as far as I'm concerned. It would be.
But well, yeah. I probably burn too much if I was on a beach. Yeah, but that's another story. I thought to myself, that's probably not for me. I don't want to walk in the same footsteps that I've done. I don't want to sell something and then spend the next 5 years trying to recreate it. So I was really interested in the story of what happens beyond that point. You know, because plenty of people are really successful and they sell their company. You know, and you can get to, I don't know, say 25 or 50 million as a turnover in your business. And I thought, well, I kind of know that journey because I've done it. So I'm kind of curious to know how do you get from 50 to 100? And that's the journey that I'm hopefully on now. I wanted to know what was the next step. And so I thought to myself, well, if I sell up, I'm never going to know. So I think there was the sense of dissatisfaction came from that. You know, lots of other companies grow and develop. We should be part of that journey too. So how do we do it?
Really interesting, because you're right. Like if an acquirer buys your business, then the reason they're doing that is because they think they can make it even bigger and better and more profitable, right? Otherwise, they wouldn't be interested.
For sure.
So there's a kind of life cycle where the entrepreneur takes things kind of as far as they know how, or they have the energy. They either run out of energy and you know, they're wanting to do something different, or they've reached the sort of ceiling of their own knowledge, experience, and kind of are plateauing, and the acquirer goes, well, we could take what they've got and we could double that and, you know, increase the value of our, you know, core business or whatever it is they're going to do. And you kind of decide, well, actually, I'm interested in that next phase of the journey. I'm, you know, I want to be part of that instead of walk away at this point, which is, yeah, that's really interesting.
Clearly, the jury's out. Well, maybe you should talk to me in 4 or 5 years' time. I'm still going to determine if I'm that man. But you know, hopefully, I am.
Right. By the way, for our listeners outside the UK, turnover is gross sales or you know, gross revenue. That's a term we use in the UK. I don't know why.
I should not be confused with net fee income. You know, fee income.
Exactly. So, well, that's a term we should explain as well.
Business, so,
because net fee income also is a British term, and it basically is your gross margin after you've paid your contractors, your interims, and so on, plus any, you know, permanent billings that you've done. So net fee income, exactly. So.
Sorry, I shall try and use a more international language.
No, not at all. I just want to make sure we're clear rather than throwing around terminology and people are confused about what we're talking about. So,
yeah, thank you.
Yeah, so revenue is turnover here, and net fee income is essentially your billings, what you are invoicing the customer minus what you're paying for your consultants, and by consultants, I mean contractors, interim people, temps, whatever you have in your business. And definitely, like my mentor Romney Ross used to say, and I know he didn't invent this term, but he's the one I learned it from, is, you know, turnover is vanity, profit is sanity, and cash is reality. So when we're working with clients and they start talking about you know, revenue goals, we're like, we don't really care about revenue. We care about GP or net fee income. What's that number? That's the one that we want to increase,
right? We're focused the same. Yeah. I think when you get to Revenue is a poor indicator on many levels, but I think with it comes challenges of scale. So you start to need, I don't know, better account software or better controls, those types of things. But you're absolutely right. We want to get our fee income to the level we'd like it to be, and hopefully the corresponding profits.
Exactly. So, Doug, what would you say has been, have been some of the biggest challenges that or constraints that you've had to navigate in order to get to where you are today?
I think it's when you're an owner manager, you carry a fair amount of the world of the weight on your shoulders. Sometimes your staff, rightly or wrongly, have perceptions of your ability or lack of ability, and it can be a little lonely as a result. So I think what I would recommend, a takeaway for anybody who is an owner manager or was an owner manager like me, is to make sure they've got a really strong management team around them. That's something I've been building over the last few years. It started by getting a chair and putting some governance in place where I was accountable to the chair, and the chair then could help me navigate a board and indeed attract the right people. So for me, I guess in the early days, you think you should be heroic and try and do everything, run the gauntlet of doing all sorts of jobs that are needed within a business. But the reality is, something that hopefully you learn is that you're really only as good as the people around you. And, you have to put your ego aside and you have to say, well, how do we get the right people in here? And it's a leap of faith for them. You know, they don't necessarily want to, particularly people who've been in big corporates, they want to join a crazy owner manager. Hopefully I'm not, but they don't want to perceive you to be that way. So I think it's essential that you get the right sort of governance in play, i.e. a chair, other people, a strong CFO that will allow you to attract the top talent that you need.
Let's dive into that, because 100% agree. You're only as strong as the people that you're surrounded with. And that is, I would say, one of the most important strategic aims for any entrepreneur who has ambitions to grow, is they have to have an ongoing and continuous focus on attracting great people. In fact, this is one of the things I was talking to James Kahn about. He's very good at this. It was one of the secrets to his success when he created Alexander Mann, is even when there was only a handful of them in the room, in a crummy office, he could persuade people to come and join his team. How have you kind of gone about that? What has been your approach?
Well, I don't think I've always got it right, if I'm honest. I think I was probably focused on, in the early days, finding people that could really drive sales. And so, that in itself is a short to medium term goal is fantastic. You engage with more clients and hopefully you make more money. But if you don't get that broader skill set in your business, all sorts of other things come along and it becomes much harder. So I was fortunate enough to go on a course on governance. I literally didn't know much about it. And somebody said to me, hey, why don't you make it a bit of fun and go to a business school? So I did. So I hopped off to INSEAD on a course. It was around governance. And it was fun because I started learning again. There's plenty of learning on the job. But I was now in a position where, I could listen to others. And the key thing that I was given, the key sort of takeaway was get yourself a really good chair and, create that governance. And so I did. I went out and talked to a number of people that I knew, and I encouraged one, Chris Clegg, to join. He'd been involved in running a private equity business before. So he'd bought lots of companies, sold a lot, and had, of course, sat on many boards and had acted as chair for a number of them. So, having his skill set was fantastic. It was an eye-opener because it was just a completely different skill set to the one I had had. And so getting Chris to join, was really great, because all of a sudden then, you can have a different relationship when you're trying to hire and attract people. You have that independence, that governance that allows you to reach out to the people that you really need.
Okay, this is interesting. Could you pronounce that for me again? Because I never know how to say that. Is it part of Oxford university's business school?
It's not. INSEAD is a business school in Fontainebleau, just south of Paris.
Okay.
It's a good European business school.
Fantastic. And what is governance? I've heard this term, but what does it really mean?
Well, I went on a course there, so I'm, you know, so I should know, but I don't know if I could. I think governance for me is making sure that you have the right structure and the right decision making in play to help you make the right decisions. So I think for me, you know, there was quite a conflict within, which is when you're wearing your CEO hat, you probably want to grow. When you're wearing your shareholders hat, you want to take out dividends and reward yourself. And, you know, when you're an owner manager, you have certain views and they may conflict with, you know, if you're thinking about, you know, other aspects of your business. So how do you navigate some of those things? So you really need to ask yourself the right questions wearing the right hat. And, you know, we can now separate some of those things through having a chair. He can help me navigate through that by getting the structure right. So understanding what's the mission of the board and how we can get that to play out in the business.
Okay, fantastic. So it was one of your four things. You said talent, structure, governance, and technology. We've talked a little bit about talent, although we kind of segued away. So coming back to, you said initially you were focused on hiring strong sales producers, basically. And then as the business matured, you added people in different areas. Could you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, I think we've sort of gone from an owner-managed strategy to more of a traditional business strategy. So if I look at the people in our top tier now, we've got two managing partners, both came from Korn Ferry or Hay Group Korn Ferry. We've got a marketing director who came from Lee Hecht Harrison. We've got a really strong CFO and a really great HRD. So these are the sorts of people that you really wouldn't need when you're half a dozen people. But when you're a bit bigger, you can bring in that talent, you know, that really can hopefully do the things you want to do. So I don't think I personally would have the skill set to be able to pivot to being a management consulting business without the likes of the two managing partners we've got, Dave and Graham. Or I don't think I would be the right person to help us rebrand and communicate those messages. But we're fortunate that we've got Kerry from Lee Hecht Harrison. Likewise, you know, relying on Debbie, our HRD, to help us improve our employee value proposition, or Martin to make sure that we're financially robust. You know, you've really got to bring in those people that are just better experts than you. You know, because if you're an owner manager and you've started out, you probably have some small company ideas that are great. But the trick is how do you get those people with those really great talents and experiences to join you to help you accelerate?
Absolutely. And something I want to ask you then, Doug, is, I can see bringing in people in, you know, finance and marketing, because those typically are not—they're completely different skill sets to someone who's come up as a recruitment consultant and, you know, maybe become a team manager or a director that way. Mm-hmm. But when you bring in someone as a managing director or managing partner, that I've seen that spectacularly backfire, where someone comes from the outside in to an established team and culture, and you know, and there's a lot of problems that can. So how did you accomplish that without? Let me just turn over to you. How did you achieve that successfully?
Well, we've achieved it. Again, you know, we're hopeful we'll achieve all that we wanted to. But we brought in Dave Lee and Graham Atkins from Korn Ferry. And we've probably been talking to them 18 months ago. And I think they joined or signed on the dotted line probably in the spring of last year. And I think they were both in the business by circa the summer period. I think that was the sort of timing. So they've been with us 9 months now. At the same time, Kerry Simmons joined us as marketing director. So there's been a lot of change here and a lot for our business to accept. So I think there's some real challenges there. There's challenges for our existing team to go, hang on a minute, who are these guys? What's all this about? And then there's some challenges for me as well on the flip side of the coin, which is how do I let them do their job and how do I allow them bring their experience to bear? So I think it's a tightrope, really, if I'm honest. And fair play to them for joining and for doing a great job. But, you know, it's difficult to navigate. And I think you probably have to really over-communicate, You have to reassure people. You have to try and take them on the journey. They have to understand what you're trying to do. And hopefully, if you're doing that, they can see that, you know, that the talent is needed to help us do what we want to do. But you know what? You won't take everybody with you. And that's always frustrating. There'll always be some that go, I kind of liked it the way it was, mm-hmm. or I don't like the way it's going, or I didn't really, you know, fancy these changes. And of course, people may also not like the personalities involved. You know, not everybody likes the idea of building a relationship with another person who's going to be their boss. So I think it's fraught with risk and fraught with challenge, mm-hmm. but you just have to look through the lens of, is this the right thing for the business? And ultimately, will it be the right thing for us to do? And hopefully it has been.
Fantastic. You said over communicate. I agree 100%. In fact, Greg Savage, I've heard say, you know, you can't over communicate. Like it's impossible. You need to, that internal communication piece is absolutely essential in order for people to feel like they know what's going on, that they understand the vision, they understand how they fit in, and you know how they're playing a part, you know, in where the business is going and what's in it for them, and all these things. So as the founder, and then you hire senior leaders and put them in place who may do things differently than you would have done it. How do you accept or reconcile that?
I think you just have to. Okay. I don't know if you have a choice in it. I think sometimes when you want to, you know, drop an email or pick up the phone. Of course, there's going to be times when you will. Of course, there is. Maybe you just can't help yourself. But you've got to really temper that, because if you're going to bring in these people, you have to let them do their job. You have to trust them. And I think if you don't trust them, there's the danger that you could undermine them. So you have to get out of the way and be respectful of the role that they've got and the difficulty that they've got in terms of inserting themselves into the business. You have to let it happen.
I guess it just basically comes down to how serious are you about growing? Because if you want to keep control of everything yourself and make all the decisions, then just through bandwidth and time, you are constraining your growth. So I guess it's a decision. Is this a lifestyle, entrepreneurial style business where you get to a certain size and then, you know, you're happy with that? Or do you really push on and continue growing? And I think the danger of being satisfied, as we talked about earlier, is maybe there's people in your business who are going to outgrow you or be more ambitious and want to progress. And if the company's not growing, then, you know, there's not new opportunities for growth and progression internally either. So then you risk losing some really good people who want bigger things than you really can offer if you're not prepared to really drive growth. So we've talked about talent. You've talked about governance a little bit. Technology, what have you guys done there that has evolved?
I think a few years ago, we did some of the basics. We put in an enterprise finance system. We put in Oracle NetSuite. So we've done the things that I'm sure thousands of other businesses do when they grow a little bit. But, you know, we were also running some legacy systems that were not particularly great for us. I don't want to name them because they're probably quite good firms, but we were running tools that were very difficult. They weren't in the cloud, so it was very difficult for us to engage with them, particularly through remote working. And so we dropped them. What we've got now is we put in Salesforce. So we've got a Salesforce strategy. Salesforce sits at the heart of what we do. And then we put in some tools that sit on it. So we've got Bullhorn that sits on Salesforce, and we run Marketo, which is marketing AI. We've got some other tools around those, but those are sort of critical to us. At the same time, we brought in Peak, which is a cornerstone product to help with learning and development. We use Cascade for HR tools. So, you know, this we're beginning to put sort of a tech stack together that will provide us with what we need. And Salesforce is great because it really gives us some great MI out of it and some opportunities to link it. And I think going forward, we want to be able to, through our Salesforce strategy, use the other tools that are available through the Salesforce marketplace to create better engagement with our clients, candidates, and participants through the likes of Salesforce community. So we're excited about where it can take us to ultimately. We're developing other products that we think you know, whether it's assessment products or the like that we think we could insert into this. But in the short term, the benefits have been powerful because all of a sudden, I think it was probably, it was actually January 2020, we went live with Salesforce. We gave everybody a laptop and we said, hey, you can work remotely or whatever. It was just remarkable timing.
Yeah, absolutely. But, I was going to say that almost was prophetic.
Truly remarkable timing that you know, people could literally go home, switch on their Surface Pro, and you know, jump on Teams or onto Salesforce.
Why do you need Salesforce and Bullhorn? I would have thought that there's a huge overlap in functionality there.
Well, what we have is Bullhorn sits on Salesforce, right. So Bullhorn described it as Bullhorn Enterprise. So yeah, there's two different products out there. There's what I think Bullhorn might describe as Bullhorn Native. You know, if anybody from Bullhorn's listening, and that's not the correct terminology, forgive me, but it is Bullhorn Native, which is their own tool. And they know that there's some companies out there want what they describe as an enterprise solution. And so they allow their software to sit on top of Salesforce. So you have the power of the Force.com platform and its integrations into finance or other sorts of things, or allowing you all of the great Salesforce capabilities that it has, but with the recruitment functionality sitting on top of it. So it's a little bit like an app that sits on Salesforce. So it's combining of the two. It's an integration. So, you know, it's hard to get right. I know that much. And we've definitely had it's plenty to digest, but I would recommend it as a tool if other people are listening and they're looking at what is in the marketplace. It's a really powerful solution because it allows you then to connect to other products that you may think are equally valuable, like marketing AI or, you know, other types of integrations that would allow you to do what you hopefully need to do.
It's at what stage did you feel that this was necessary? Because I know I have another client that's a hypergrowth company, and they also use Salesforce, and it's a powerful platform. But every time they want to customize or add an integration, it's super expensive because, you know, it's not as simply a case of, you know, clicking a few buttons and then things talk to each other seamlessly. So they have to really make a proper evaluation if they want, okay, well, what do we need it to do? And it's not native, so we want to add this software. So how are they going to talk to each other? And it becomes pretty expensive. When do you think that becomes worthwhile?
I don't know. I guess we just wanted something that it wasn't so much future-proofed. We wanted the flexibility. We'd been with a system before that really didn't give us any flexibility. And so maybe we should have just gone and got Bullhorn. And in fact, my finance director's here, he would probably say, yeah, you should have gone and done that. But, you know, we were thinking, well, what is it we'd like to have in the future? And so we had this vision of being able to have these tools that could talk to each other through open APIs. And we knew that if we got Salesforce in and we had a Salesforce strategy, Salesforce sitting at the very center, we knew that we'd be able to achieve all that we wanted to do. So I'd say, yes, it can be expensive, but you can bring in some of the expertise in-house. But really, you need what I would describe as a good Salesforce delivery partner. And there's certainly some out there. If you can meet one of those and you have that sort of really good relationship where they understand your roadmap, then you can achieve what you need to do, and it's not as expensive as you might imagine.
Fantastic, Doug. Looking back over the journey that you've been on, what would you have done differently, you know, if you had a chance to do it again?
Wow, where do I start? I think I would have probably moved away from the name Interim Partners sooner to provide a broader solution. Mm-hmm. I think there's lots of things. Do you know what I think I probably would have done? I would have probably tried to have held on to people, some of them that I had at the very beginning. We kind of accepted that some people would come and go, and I don't think I truly understood the cost of attrition and the damage it can do to your business. So I think I would have probably, you know, try to exercise a little bit more maturity, a bit more emotional intelligence, and have those types of skills in terms of dealing with the proud egos of some of our most successful people. So some of them have gone on, they've become entrepreneurial, some of them have gone on and had really fantastic careers. I'm grateful that they were part of our business at the time. So I think it's learning to understand that you are a company of people. I think that would be one of the things that I would have considered more so in my early stages, and certainly my management style and how I approach stuff. I'd like to think I'm far less of a bull in a china shop now than I was in my early 30s. So I think it's some of those softer skills that, you know, how do you work on your emotional intelligence or your communication style, or having greater empathy with where your colleagues are at, and you know where they are in their career paths, all of those sorts of things. I wish I'd had a bit more insight there. I think some of the other stuff, you know, whether it's putting together a system or a website, all of those sorts of things, then I don't have too many regrets. I'm sure I've wasted more money than most on these sorts of things, but I've learned a lot from it as well. And I think the collateral damage there is just overspending as opposed to you know, anything else. So I think it would be some of the softer skills that I think, you know, that good leaders should have today. And I'm hopeful I've got some of that now.
Fantastic. That's a great answer. And so what have been some of the practical things that you've put in place in order, for example, to address improving your employee engagement and retention of key people? What does that look like today at New Street Consulting Group?
Well, we're actually working on our employee value proposition at the moment, and we're asking our colleagues, you know, why they like being here. But along the way, we've had some really good insights as well. We first started doing Investors in People many, many years ago, and we used to do questionnaires, or investors would do questionnaires to our staff, and we'd get different insights then. So some of the insights were, hang on a minute, you don't do too much on CSR. Could you not do more of that as a business? Or, hey, hang on a minute, you know, we would really like to understand more about what you're trying to do with the business. So we've learned through things, through those sorts of things. And more recently, we've been in Best Companies, as you mentioned. Again, there's a similar approach, which is they do an assessment of you, and those assessments are really useful. But I think the sorts of things that we've done, what have been the learnings from that? Well, I guess we've tried a variety of things, and we're still trying them. We've tried from one end of the spectrum. We've tried deferred bonuses, where we enhance the bonus but defer it so that we're building up a pot that is really valuable to people. So it's kind of a bit like an LTIP for recruitment consultants. At the other end of the spectrum, we've got a growth share scheme that's for our board that 25% of the equity is being put into so that they can benefit from it. So there's sort of what you might describe as the financial things, but of course, they only go some way to solving the problem. It's making sure that you've got a really good collaborative environment, that you can listen, that there's good management and leadership, that there's a culture where people can talk and share. Hybrid working has definitely been really, really important. I think pre-pandemic, we were all nervous about it and anxious, and probably as many owner managers or CEOs I know that quietly said to me and to the people in the room, we don't think it's a good idea, but I'm absolutely sure that nobody thinks that now. We know that hybrid working is working for us, and indeed, it's certainly working for our colleagues. They need that flexibility. So I think there's a range of things that you can put in place, but you know, you there's what we've discovered is you need to do not one lever, but probably pull 50 or 100 levers with your colleagues. It isn't just the case of a financial reward, far from it, and it isn't just the case of flexible working or great tech or really nice office spaces. It's about hopefully showing them that you're doing meaningful work, that they're doing meaningful work, that the business is transitioning into an exciting space, and that they can see an opportunity for them to be part of it. So I think those are the sorts of things that I think we're working on at the moment. You know, this notion of giving a clearer view of what our purpose is, how they can impact upon what we're doing. Those are the sorts of and a nice office or a nice workplace.
100%. Absolutely. Great answer. Thanks, Doug. Listen, is there anything I haven't asked you today that you had wanted to share?
I don't know, but I'd have to watch this and cringe and listen to myself going through this and see if I've missed anything. But look, all I can say is I'm grateful for the opportunity, and you know, I've really enjoyed it.
Oh, my pleasure. I have too. Really enjoyed the conversation, and lots of insight there, Doug, that I think will be valuable to entrepreneurs who do want to, you know, have that ambition. They want to grow and evolve, you know, from a sort of founder, you know, lifestyle business to, you know, a larger small medium enterprise, and you've, you know,
My pleasure.
Been really valuable. Thank you so much.